This episode of the Inner Hoe Uprising is sponsored by BetterHelp.
This episode of the Inner Hoe Uprising is also available for your viewing pleasures on YouTube. If looking at people while they podcast is your thing, then you can click the YouTube link in our show notes and gaze along as we talk our shit. Inner Hoe Welcome to the Inner Hoe Uprising, the podcast about sex, love, and dating from the perspective of me, Sam, one black, non-monogamous, pansexual, feminist hoe who lives in New York City and whose pronouns are she and they.
And Akua, your favorite demisexual mental health therapist who just realized she's also omnisexual instead of sexually fluid. Haha.
Love that for you. Love that Thank a lot you. For you. Every episode of the Inner Hoe Uprising works like this. Myself and my lovely rotating co-hosts talk about sex, love, and dating as it pertains to current events in the world, our lives, and yours. And occasionally we hit you with interviews with insightful folks or do deep dive episodes on a topic of our choice. This episode is a fun one. We will be joined by an extremely bad bitch to talk all about the sexual liberation journey of a black disabled woman, kink and navigating the lifestyle as both an LG and a dom, the journey transitioning from social worker to sex therapist, and so much more. So stay tuned.
If you would like to follow along with the conversation had in this podcast on social media, you can do so by using the hashtag Inner Hoe Uprising so we can see it and the hashtag Podin so other people can see it. If you would like to follow us on social media, you can do so at Inner Hoe Uprising without the G on Twitter, at Inner Hoe Uprising with the G on Instagram and Facebook. You can join our Facebook group by searching Inner Hoe Uprising Community. That is C-U-M-M-U-N-I-T-Y. And you can head to innerhoeuprising.com to pay a hoe.
And to buy merchandise very yes. soon. Hey, hey. Also, if you want a place to speak at your school or conference, whether virtually or in person, about sex positivity, black feminism, or the other kinds of topics that we discuss on this here show, we would love to book us. You can send us a line to ihupodcast@gmail.com. We also do consent, pleasure, and dating workshops. I shine bright, in all my different colors, We shine bright in all our different colors, Okay. All right. So we are going to get now into our first and only segment of the day. Today, we are talking with Vylissa Thompson all about the bad bitch, future sex therapist, kinky asshole that she is. I hope you're okay with me titling you as such. Okay. I'm just typing it like, we'll just go with it and see what happens. If not, we'll cut it out. Do you want to read the bio, Akua?
Of course. And I just have to say, Vylissa, we had to cut down your bio a little bit. And I was like, she's just going to be this much of a bad bitch. I feel like we are not giving you your flowers by having to condense your bio. But we had to for the sake of like time.
The way that I put it is that a bad bitch cannot be contained by the confines of a 1 hour podcast.
Exactly.
So I told Sam in email, cut down how much you want.
No, we gotta give her her flowers. But we got
all the publications, Elizabeth Warren's campaign. It's just like left, right, everywhere.
But to hear a snippet of how much of a bad bitch Vylissa is, Vylissa Thompson, pronouns she and her, is a licensed master social worker, founder and CEO of Ramp Your Voice, which is an organization focused on promoting self-advocacy and strengthening empowerment among disabled people. She's also a disability rights consultant, writer, activist, and creator of the viral and much-needed hashtag disability2white. She has been featured in and written for various publications, including Time Magazine's Vision of Equity, issued in 2021, in Essence for its Black History Now 2019 series, and its Woke 100 Women 2018 list, as well as CNN, Healthline, Rewire, and other media outlets. Everything she does revolves around being unapologetically herself, Black, disabled, and making good trouble to shake up the status quo. Welcome, Vylissa.
I'm so glad to be on here with y'all.
Yes. We are so excited to have you and to hop into this conversation. Ooh. So we figure this is a whole podcast. Let's get into whole things.
Mm-hmm. Yes.
So
I want to say, if you want to know more about, you know, Vylissa and her work as a disability activist, that is plentifully documented everywhere. Google her, literally Google her, okay? But we're going to talk about the whole thing. We're going to get into it.
This is a smut podcast.
All right.
So yeah, let's hop into your sexual liberation journey. Tell us about your journey towards sexual liberation, when that process began, and what has it looked like?
Yeah, so for me, kind of had an unconventional education and journey into sex. I understand what sex is due to my mother, who's an LPN, licensed practicing nurse, and she would send me, because she lived in D.C. until I was 11. I was raised with my grandmother here in South Carolina, and so she would send me different pamphlets and things to read. Because I was a nerdy kid, you know, like most kids want to be a doctor or something like that. And so she would, you know, support my interests, and she would send me different health pamphlets. And within those health pamphlets and brochures would be things about sex. And my mother's not the most attentive person, so I don't know whether she was really paying attention as to what she was putting into these packages, but they had different things about HIV/AIDS, you know, different types of how to protect yourself. You know, when it comes to sex, safe sex, some queer stuff that was in there about gay sex or lesbian sex, you know, girl on girl, guy on guy, things that nature. So being 10 and 11, reading those materials, it really allowed me to have an understanding about sex from a medical standpoint. No, you shouldn't be having sex, but if you're going to engage, here are the ways that you can protect yourself, you know, from either pregnancy or STIs, and how to ensure pleasure between you and your partner. So that just really kind of opened me up into understanding sex from this lens. And it's allowed my curiosity to grow. And that really helped me, because in middle school, so like a couple of years after kind of reading these materials, you know, middle school is around the time you may go to the sex ed classes. But for me, I didn't go to PE classes where the sex ed stuff was taught. So for me, I didn't really get that type of education, but since I already had the materials, I felt that I didn't really miss, quote unquote, miss out, because here in South Carolina, that most likely taught absence only. So, you know, you're kind of going to get a watered down version of that anyway. But it made me think about, particularly as I get into this work, how a lot of disabled students are not taught sex ed, you know, in our schools, are prevented from attending those courses, and how that leads to many disabled people not understanding what sex is, or how to protect themselves, you know, how to report something if they're violated, how to ask for consent or give consent. So it kind of starts this building block of the separation of disabled students versus their non-disabled peers, and understanding their bodies, their feelings, their hormones, you know, the inner workings of a growing body as a young person. Mm-hmm. So, and looking back on it, I didn't necessarily miss out, but I know that if I did not have that type of unintentional education based on the materials, then I would have. And I would have been, you know, the stereotype of a disabled student not understanding sex through my school, who did provide that information. So that was kind of like my early days in, you know, understanding sex, and then realizing, okay, how do I feel about this as a teenager and as, you know, a young woman, you know, going to college for the first time and having a boyfriend for the first time, and really taking what I've known and really putting it into relationships, and also having a conversation with my friends too about sex. And you realize that a lot of Black women and families, a lot of us, even if we're, you know, whether disabled or not, you know, are not really taught about sex in a very open manner. You know, I remember having a conversation with friends who didn't really understand their own autonomy, you know, down there, even though they was fooling around with their boyfriends and stuff. You have to be armed with information to know how to find pleasure and to feel good. And even today, having conversations with some of the same women in our 30s now, how they're still trying to figure out how to be sexually expressive and be liberated. And for me, it just really makes me appreciate that I've had those unconventional learning, you know, at 10 or 11, that really helped me today at 35 to really understand my body, what I like, what I don't like, how to be vocal, not to be so taboo in expressing myself, particularly being raised, you know, under the Bible Belt, you know, here in South Carolina, you know, just really pushing back on those Christian values and also just some cultural, you know, norms that we have about sexuality mm-hmm. in our community that really shaped me to be unconventional in how I look at sex and my comfortability in talking about it.
That is like so dope that these just pamphlets by chance, like
they were pretty graphic, not like in a explorative way, but you know, for a 10-year-old looking at me, I'm like, wow, that's a penis, you know, or like, wow, that's that. So it was just like graphic from my mind, but also I understood like, wow, the nerdy in me at 10 was like, oh wow, this is cool. And also making sure that I hid them from my grandmother because I had enough sense to know.
Okay, I was gonna ask that too, like how was that being received?
Like, she never knew about the pamphlets, you know, at least the sex one. She knew about the other ones, but I had enough sense to hide those.
I'm not sure whether this is due to like geographic location or just aging. We're kind of aging ourselves, Violissa, or, you know, both. But I remember growing up, health and PE were put together. And now in New right. York, they're separate classes. So I don't know if it's because you were older or kind of grew up during the time where they were combined, or if it was just, you know, the South Carolina school system or both. But it kind of, this kind of pick, what you've mentioned piggybacked off of a conversation I was just having, as my son has cerebral palsy. He is a disabled person. And when he is in school, when pre-pandemic, he's to be having like adaptive PE, which is a separate course or integrated course than the PE kids have. And I'm thinking, you know, how much would he have missed if health and PE were now together? And I was just mentioning that I've been, you know, a neglectful parent and that I've been allowing him to skip health during remote lessons because he's truly not interested. But how, you know, my conversations, much like your mother sent those pamphlets, I have conversations about sex and sexual orientation and, you know, his body and puberty and all these things with him. You know, if I wasn't having that conversation and allowing him to miss health, how much would he miss out on, you know?
Yeah, definitely. I know now when I went to high school, I did take health and PE. Mm-hmm. So I don't know why they allowed me to skip it in middle school. Middle school was a wild time, you know, with like that particular school that I went to. But I did, they were separate. So I went to PE, but it really wasn't adaptive. I just kind of was there just to make sure I got credit. But in health class, we did go over some things, but I don't remember us going in depth on like sex ed or abstinence only criteria. So that doesn't, I don't remember that going, you know, that deeply. But it makes me think about the kid, like for me, I was in mainstream classrooms. So I wasn't under the, you know, attended the quote unquote special education classes. So it makes me wonder for the kids who were in the special education classes, what were they getting yeah. or not getting?
Yeah.
You know, even if they had opportunity to attend PE in middle school and high school, you know, what were they learning or what were they not learning? And that kind of goes back to what I was saying earlier about that separation of disabled students in our schools, whether they're in mainstream or in, you know, special ed or the, you know, adaptive classrooms.
You kind of touched on this earlier when you were like South Carolina, like at some point I wasn't missing anything anyway because these pamphlets were probably better. And so I'm wondering, right. even when it comes to the pamphlets and when you eventually took health classes in high school and stuff like that, were they, because there's this kind of like flattening when it comes to what bodies can do and what bodies have sex and stuff like that. Did you find that there were things targeted that address sexuality when it comes to disabled people, or was that something you just had to like find out on your own elsewhere?
Yeah, none of that covered. Even when my grandmother kind of, when I, you know, after I got my period and started to developing, I remember her taking me to the health department and getting like some of the official brochure by them. And it was just like, you know, you're changing body and kind of what to expect. My grandmother wasn't going to talk to me about that mm-hmm. stuff. But at least she knew, you know, to take me somewhere yeah. where I can get that information. Uh-huh. But even in those pamphlets, there was nothing related to disability on that. Mm. You know, even my doctors growing up, they never talked about the sexuality part. So it really took me kind of really coming into this space and activism to find disability specific sex materials, you know, on what it's like to be a disabled person, have a sex, learn about adaptive toys and, you know, learn about different positions and just learn about, you know, disabled women, femmes, those assigned female at birth, you know, our experiences with our bodies and what does that look like. So it really took me being a full adult to really gain those materials that was not around in the early 2000s when I was in high school. So yeah, just night and day. And I hope that this generation of, you know, disabled, you know, middle schoolers and high schoolers get to find the information, if it's not in their schools, hopefully online.
Vilissa, would you mind sharing some of those resources with us, but specifically me? Because as you were talking, I realized how much of an ableist approach I've been taking in teaching my son, you know, sex ed and, you know, about himself. And I definitely want to widen that up. So yeah, if you could share those with me, I'd really appreciate it. Yeah, as well as our audience, anybody can use
them. I know that when it was more active, Tumblr was a great place. I know that's like very old school, but Tumblr was where I found disabled people talking very candidly about sex, you know, and our experiences. And also that led to certain articles, you know, none that really stick out at the moment, but to me, just really Googling things has been really helpful. You know, I think there's a few websites that really targets disability and sex. And if you type that into a search engine, you'd be able to find some of them. But that is how I really started to learn more about how we as a people started to really think about sex, and also realizing that there's not a lot of us as skin folks who are talking about sex in this way, and how many of us are trying to, you know, create this bridge of race, gender, sexuality, and disability so that it's not just white disabled guys or white disabled women talking about their experiences. Mm-hmm. Or even if they have other marginalized identities like being queer or trans, because the experiences for Black disabled people who are queer or trans are different when it comes to coming out or being invited in, you know, and learning about how to navigate that and cultural norms within the Black community, figuring out, you know, the ableism within queer communities and the racism within queer communities. So that's a lot there that Black disabled queer and trans people experience. So, you know, it's, you know, in a broader sense, you know, just typing in sex and disability can find you things, but I know there are certain folks who have really brought that racial aspect in, whether it comes to just talking about sexuality in general or going into kink or BDSM. So there are those of us out there, but they're not as heavily broadcasted as the white perspective.
So tired of white supremacy. Yeah, I'm just so tired of white supremacy. Yes. Why do it always come back to that?
Yes.
And so, you know, you had mentioned not being able to kind of tap fully into these resources until, I guess, like the mid, I guess the aughts. So in the early 2000s, high school and college and stuff like that, what were some of your... feel free to not answer, but what were some of your first sexual experiences like?
I think that, you know, I was like an old virgin in a way. I call it old virgin. I didn't really have my first encounter until after college. Mm-hmm. So I'm in my 20s at this point. And that was a little intentional to where I was like, oh, I really wasn't ready. You know, me and the guy I was dating at the time, who was my first boyfriend, it was long distance because he lived in like the area where we are from, and then I was at my alma mater, so we see each other whenever I came home, we'd have a break, and it was also kind of off and on too, so it wasn't the best situation. But yeah, it was just a, you know, in my early 20s, but you know, before then, you know, this was the age of, you know, online chat rooms, so you know, there was a lot of, you know, online, you know, sex talk going on, you know, emails, instant messenger.
Same.
So that just really kind of opened me up into that world of, you know, how to, you know, engage with like sexting or sex talk virtually. So that was, I think, one of my first encounters of expressing myself to someone else, you know, just kind of being in chat rooms and talking, you know, in that way to guys, and then having that encounter at, you know, in my early 20s, and then, you know, just really kind of figure out my, you know, kind of what I wanted, you know, when it comes to sex, you know, really seeing how men engage with me. I predominantly date men, sadly.
Girl.
You know, but just realizing that for some men, they don't care about the disability. For some men, it is kind of a big deal. For some, it's a little fetishizing going on. You know, so just really encountering that too as, you know, 20-something. And it's like, wow, you know, this is how people look at disabled folks, you know, being someone in their 20s. I've had, you know, older guys try to talk to me, whatever like that. And I found that older guys typically don't care about your disability, which is a good thing because they're not superficial, quote unquote. But also it's like, you're also older. So how much can you really judge me based on what you may be having going on if you're like in your 30s or 40s and your own body changes that you're going through at that age? But it really made me, you know, more confident that there's somebody who would like, you know, a disabled woman who is in a wheelchair under 4 feet tall. So, you know, so it made me feel some type of confidence in that. But also it made me kind of get a little snappy with guys who would be a little intrusive about how tall I am. And just like, not in a fetishizing way, but just in a nosy way. I'm like, you either want to talk or you don't. Like it's not that big of a deal. And just me kind of being an asshole, you know, to some of them, and being, yes, and being a smart ass and really gaining that too. And just learning to slowly not care about men's feelings. Because I don't think that we get to the point to where, you know, till you're older, like in my, at 35 now, I really don't give a damn about men's feelings. But starting that in my early to mid 20s, yeah, start to slowly care less about men's feelings and to really, you know, take hold of the fact that if you're not engaged with me in a way that's really makes me feel safe or makes me feel comfortable, then I don't have to do that. So just really learning about that too. And also just realizing that, you know, some guys are just going to be weird regardless of how you look like and how you engage. And just, you know, they're just going to be some creepers out there. But also just understanding that some people are kind of weird about the disability. You know, they don't know what to say or don't know how what to ask or know how to engage. And just also not internalizing that either. But sometimes, you know, when you're younger, you may, you know, the pressure to be perfect or be like everybody else is still there, even if you're in your 20s. So just really understanding that if anybody has an issue, that there is on them and not me, and to not really care as much either, you know, about people's discomfort. But yeah, like some guys, like I said, care about it. Some guys don't. For me, this is my life. You know, this is the only life that I know. So it's a big part of what I do. And I want you to care, but not to the point to where it's detrimental to the way that you see and value me as a person, as a potential lover, as a potential partner. So really having that balance, you know, and I think it's really hard to find guys, you know, that's our age and then, you know, just any age really, that's really, you know, not superficial. I think that's the one thing I find it as I get older is that, you know, guys are still superficial in so many ways. And then not just about like looks, but just about, you know, maturity and, you know, emotional availability, you know, just shifting that immaturity, you know, from the superficial to what I value today as an older woman of a certain age.
Shout out to the chat rooms, because that just sounds like a great foundation.
When you mentioned it, because I remember being in chat rooms as a child during the 2000s and hearing your perspective as a more older, you know, older person in the chat rooms in 2000. I was like, oh, so in the 2000s, we were just all in chat rooms.
That was
just
all the in age. The chat rooms. Yeah. Yes, because I was talking to older people at like 13.
Exactly.
Yeah. Yeah,
that was the time.
And it's wild. It's a wild time. Because, yeah, I stopped being in chat room probably around the time I graduated from grad school, which was like 2012. That's when, like, the chat room started to phase out. And then you go on sites like Twitter and Tumblr or whatever like that. You know, but, yeah, like, the chat rooms were popping back then.
Yes, they were. You know? Yes, they were. The heyday of online online activities.
The beginning of the whole shit.
So exactly. I have a question, because we are going to transition this conversation at some point into kink, because that's something that we really want to talk to you about. And so I'm wondering, was it in the chat room days where you started to kind of find out what you were into in terms of kinks and stuff like that?
Yeah, I started meeting guys who were definitely into kink, but I didn't really want to engage with them like that. Mm-hmm. But it wasn't really again, circle back to Tumblr, like when I really started to know about kink more. And I think that with all its faults, Tumblr was a great place to have a beginner's one-on-one understanding of what kink is, what BDSM is, you know, from the information alone, you know, that was shared. That was actually good information, you know, out there. So that really started my journey in that. And also meet other disabled folks who are also interested in their lifestyle and seeing their experiences, you know, the ableism within the community, the inaccessibility, particularly when you go to dungeons and events and how they may not be equipped to handle structurally, you know, to handle those of us with physical disabilities like wheelchairs, canes, you know, and also safety of certain people, you know, whose disability may not be physical, but they may have sensory needs that, you know, these spaces may not take into consideration. You know, also safety, being able to express yourself, you know, in a way, also not being taken advantage of, particularly if you are a submissive and, you know, and disabled, you know, so just really understanding safety in that way and how to spot predators or devotees, particularly just people who have a fetishization for disabled people. And especially for me as the one who's a little woman, definitely have that on my radar. So that just really allowed me to have to kind of build this foundation of just understand what this lifestyle was in general, because around the time where I started to learn about it, this was in the heyday of 50 Shades of Grey. You know, so we already have that. Can you even remember? Can you believe that? That's almost 10 years ago. Like the phenomenon of 50 Shades of Grey and understanding how that was not a good portrayal of BDSM and understanding the why. So really coming off of reading reading that book, coming to the community and realizing what the book got wrong. And like, oh, okay. So that really helped to get me understanding as to what the community is versus what it isn't, and how to form my identity and figure out the different identities that exist in there.
That was one of the best, maybe I guess the only thing about 50 Shades of Grey is how many people like, I guess kind of like we're like, oh, kink exists, and then started to look into actual information and stuff like that.
Yes.
All the people it's directed to actual factual resources because, oh goodness.
I know, like the phenomenon of that book was just bananas.
Just
all the abuse and coercion. I just couldn't, we're not going to get to it.
Very sad. Man, there's people on Hinge to this day that think that's what kink is, though, unfortunately. So not everybody became a convert.
No, definitely not. Sadly.
Very sad. But in terms of, like, so we know Tumblr and 50 Shades of Grey was, like, what opened your eyes to kink. What drew you to it? Like, what turned you on about it?
I think learning that it's not just, I think the different pairings of sorts, like, the different, it's not just master slave, you know, because that was always in my mind, just kind of understanding kink is like just that type of dynamic is the main one that people know about. It's like, no, there's different parameters. So like for me, I'm a part of, well, I see myself as a little girl of the LGDD daddy dom, you know, pairing. And I'm like, okay, this is a little quote unquote softer, this is more my speed, you know. I don't, you know, for me as a woman who's have to be the dominant one in everything that I do. You know, I'm an only child. I'm the responsible one in my family and the friend group. You know, I own my own business. Like, I have to be the lead in everything else. But learning about being an LG makes me be like, okay, I can give up this control to somebody else. You know, and that's what I like about, you know, that particular dynamic is that I can give up that control and trusting someone else to do that. And it's not a harsh relationship dynamic. You know, I just want to just be there, be doted on, be cared for, and not have to think about anything. Have, you know, my partner be the lead on our sexual life. And also, if I want him to lead that in our day-to-day, that too, and kind of have that fully integrated into our everyday life. So for me, that dynamic kind of fit the bill for me more. And it was like, okay, this is pretty cool. And in that, really come to terms with what is it like to be a disabled person who society looks at as always having to be cared for. So kind of dealing with that ableism too of, oh, you're a disabled person, you must, you know, you can't possibly be a caregiver or be independent. Someone must always take care of you. And I know that for some LGs that I've met, really combated that stereotype of wanting to be an LG, but also understanding ableism and, you know, in the, you know, inaccurate understanding that disabled people can only be cared for, and make sure that our partners that we engage with understand that this is a role that we care about, but we are fully independent in the ways that we can be. And there's nothing wrong with caring for someone, whether they're disabled or not. And I think we have a very twisted understanding of what caring for each other is, because in relationship dynamics, you do care for the other person, you know? And I think that's the thing we don't really think about is, you know, that every relationship, somebody's supposed to be the caregiver, someone's gonna be the caree, and that's okay. You know, and those roles switch in reverse. But I think for me as a disabled woman, I don't want my partner, want any partner, whether we're in this BDSM dynamic or not, to see his role as being a caregiver because of the ableism there. You know, we are two people coming together. And yeah, there may be times you may have to take care of me that may not be disability related. And there may be times I have to take care of you that may not be health related. So just having that understanding, I think that's really been very intentional for me to really sort out. And I know I'm not the only LG that's had to do that, but just really sort that out. And also being an LG, you know, you have the, depends on the age. I don't really have a particular age when it comes to my LG. I just want to be cared for. I can do like some of the activities, like, you know, some LGs like to color, you know, and be cared for. Like those things are fine for me, but I don't have a particular age that I go into. But I know that for me, just making sure that as someone who's under 4 feet tall, just make sure that, you know, my autonomy isn't stripped away because I may want to be little that day, and to have that respected. So I think for me, within the LG dynamic, respect is very key and very prominent, so that lines don't get crossed to where they may be ableist leaning, or someone may be a little too dominant and not knowing how it can look like.
Mm-hmm. I have a question going that way, but we're actually going to circle back a little bit because Aku is very curious about the LG dynamic and wants to explore that a little bit more. And then I'll ask my question.
Even that, because you have just taken this conversation on a multi-path, and I'm just like, the nuance you have provided us, Violissa, I'm just like, I don't even know where to go. Okay, let me sort that out. So first, for our non-kinky listeners, can you plainly define what an LG is? And then I'll follow up with the other follow-up questions. We just got questions on questions.
Yeah. It's basically similar to the dynamics of master-slave, submissive. It's, you know, a different naming of those categories, but it's not as, so for me and how I define it, it's not as harsh as those others, where, you know, by harsh, I mean the control aspect that I see, like with the other dynamics, you know, it's more of a tenderness. It's more of a caring, you know, it's kind of have a, I would say like father figure in a way, because I know it could be kind of incestuous, but it's more of a, for me, it's more of a caring, you know, doting, cared for, like, this is my baby girl, I take care of her, you know, she loves on me, I feel kind of big and strong as her daddy dom, you know, and things of that nature. So for me, it's a little bit more playful. It's a more playful dynamic. It's more, you know, it's more tender, you know, and that's kind of what I would like to do if I am to relinquish my dominance in my everyday life and be more softer in this dynamic. That's how I look at the LG versus the other roles.
So LG, and I think me and Sam had to Google this just to make sure, LG stands for like little girl.
Yeah, little girl. And like if it's a guy, be little boy.
Mm-hmm. And it has like this age parent kind of dynamic to it.
Yeah.
But not so much when we think of like, because there's also a relationship of like parents and like babies.
No. Like there's like, some folks who can be the age dynamic. Some people are like little kids, like I'd say like kindergarten, or some of them can be like the bigger kids, or maybe late elementary, some could be adolescent age. So it depends on the LG or LB, they may tap into their little based on the age criteria that they kind of fall under. Mm-hmm. I don't have an age criteria. I just kind of like the engagement. Mm-hmm. But that's what I'm mostly focused on. But some people do go into an age dynamic, mm-hmm. that they role that they play, and their partner, the dominant one, can kind of be the dope team.
Mm-hmm. So when we were coming up with the questions around these kinks, especially LG, I remember telling Sam that I conflated the idea of being a brat with being an LG, because I know I can identify.
Some people are brats. Some people are brats.
I am.
Some people are brats, and I could be a little bratty too, you know, a little bit, because that's like, you know, that's the playful side, mm-hmm. right? You know, that like you want what you want. And in that, you can be a little brat.
But Sam also, you know, Sam clarified, because she was like, I too am a brat, but I'm a big girl. Like, I am an adult, just a brat. And I realized I didn't know there was a name for this, but I am a little girl, but also a brat. And I think I had made the two one in the same, because I didn't know of the term. I didn't know that there was also something else that fit that criteria. So you opened my eyes for that. Do you mind going into a little bit of the difference between a brat and an LG?
Like, to me, I'm not that bratty, so I haven't really dig into that part. But I think, like, bratty to me would just be, like, more demanding, more I want my way, you know, more kind of making a fuss and sometimes getting punished, because that's part of the dynamic. You know, like, doing things that can irritate your dom or madam, you know, or mommy, you know, and just really get punished, get on their nerves, you know, just like, I'm just like, you know, like,
yes.
Like, you know, not to emphasize us anyway, mm-hmm. but, you know, just to really see that you get to be a, like a kid, you know, and your dom is the one to kind of get you in line, have to provide punishment, whatever that mm-hmm. is, you know, but also caring for you as well, even in your brightness, make sure that you have what you need, you know, and, you know, just really, to me, I just feel like that dynamic is just a little not, like I said, as, you know, severe as others, because that's not really my tone. Mm-hmm. You know, I'm more of a kind of laid back type of person. And for me, in the LG relationship that I want to have, that's kind of the interaction that I want to have, more laid back, more playful, more caring.
And so to jump forward again, kind of when you were talking about, and I think that's very interesting, the dynamic of wanting to be cared for, but like, okay, not in this way. Like, let's put the hard right. limits here. What are some things where you're like, okay, this is verging into ableist territory, or maybe this feeds into our next question. Like, what type of qualities are you looking for in a dom versus what you're not looking for? Or what are like some red flags versus green flags?
I say definitely red flags of people who just really hyper vigilant about the disability part. Mm. That's always a red flag for mm-hmm. me. People who cannot get over the disability part, to where they do this whole, oh wow, you're so inspirational. I'm like, I want to fuck. I'm like, I don't want you to tell me that.
I don't want to be inspired. I'm trying to fuck.
I'm trying to fuck. Like, just because on my dating profile, I have that I'm a witcher, because like, that's not myself. Like, hi, you know, I know there is debate within the disability community about whether whether or not you disclose, you know, whether you're disabled or not, and the responses. But for me, I'm like, my disability is very visible. There's no way that I can hide this. So, you know, I'm going to have it disclosed. So I'm in a wheelchair, you know, I talk about my disability. And for some guys, it's a put off, and some guys it's not. But I've had messages from guys who are like, oh my gosh, you know, I read your profile and you're so amazing. And I'm like, weirdo, get out of my messages. Like, you ain't trying to say hello, what's up, right. baby girl? Like, yeah. No. So definitely those are the red flags of people who, you know, mean well, and I use that very loosely, but just don't know what to say. And I'm like, if you don't know what to say, that you're being uncomfortable is not going to be my problem, you know. So those are the red flags for me. But I think the green flags is just learning, understanding that you may have some, I say curiosity, particularly, you know, I'm not going to act like people are out here always dating disabled folks. But I understand that for many people, this may be their first encounter dating a disabled person who is visibly disabled, you know, because a lot of us are here with not apparent or invisible disabilities. But for those of us with physical disabilities, you know, it's a different ball game, and realizing that you may be there first or maybe one or two, and how they really engage with that. And that's understanding their understanding of disability, how they view disabled people. You know, these are all the green flags. And they talk about disability in a way, even if it's not perfect language, but you realize that they're learning, you know, and it's not offensive. You know, it's like, okay. Or if we have to correct them, they take it and they internalize it, and they actually get better at it. You know, those are the green flags. Because I don't expect any partner of mine to have this overarching understanding of disability. You know, for me, that's unrealistic. For somebody else, that may be their standard, and that's fine. But for me, that's unrealistic because I see it in my work that I do is consulting and doing trainings. People don't know anything, and these are professionals. So I'm not going to expect the average person who may or may not be a professional that may or may not engage with disabled people to have a higher standard of understanding, higher level of understanding. But for me, just being open to talk about, hey, you know, just some things that I don't know about, let's talk about it. Or, you know, their concerns about, you know, if we get intimate, how does that work? This open-mindedness is very key for me as a green flag. You know, just willingness to be vulnerable, you know, and let me know how they feel about things. And also having a good understanding of who they are as a person, because I'm used to getting stared at in public, you know, and whispers. And I need that person to be confident in that. You know, if people mistake you for my caregiver and not my partner, I need you to speak up for that. You know, I need you to call that type of ableism out, you know, to really understand that we're in this together, and to talk about, you know, maybe your own realizations of how people are trash to disabled folks, you know, just being honest about that, but also having the confidence, the maturity to handle that, and to be able to be willing to date a disabled person and not forget that ableism exists. And also to combat your own types of ableism. You know, you may be comfortable with dating a person in a wheelchair, but you may have some, you know, messed up thoughts about those with other disabilities. So really combating that and opening your own understanding of what disability is, because this is a part of my work. And if you're going to be in my life, then you're going to have some understanding of what this is. So those are the green flags for me, just open-mindedness, willing to learn, to be vulnerable, have maturity, be emotionally present and available, you know, being confident within yourself. But those things are sexy to me, you know, particularly at this age, like looks matter, you know, to it. Yeah. You know, I don't want somebody who I can only take out at night, you know, but, you know, but I do want somebody who, you know, would be good to me and good for me, mm-hmm. you know, and that goes well beyond. Mm-hmm. Anything on the surface.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm, mm-hmm. Quick question before Akua gets more into kink. I guess this could be applied to kink and just like dating in general, vanilla or otherwise. Dating is exhausting in general. Like, do we all yes. agree with that? Okay, cool. We're on the same playing field.
Yeah.
And so like in general, like let's say you're just the plainest white man, you got to explain shit about yourself to other people. But then when you layer on being disabled and being a black woman, do you ever like take breaks, or are you tired of the bullshit? Because I feel like there's a lot of explaining that you have to do.
Yeah, like I do a lot of online dating, and guys are just boring. Like they don't know what to say. They don't know what to say. I'd be like, "Hey, how you doing?" Like,
chilling, relaxing.
You talk for a little while, and they don't say nothing, and I'm just like, especially if they message you first. Yeah. I'm just like, so you ain't got nothing to say. what is it here? You know, I do take breaks. I take a lot of different breaks. And I haven't made this known publicly, but I am considering doing matchmaking. Because I'm tired of feeling that. I feel that. And I feel like I'm not doing this right. So let me just, that's an idea. Take over, because you can't do any worse than what I'm doing right now, you know. But I am considering that because, yeah. you know, being a certain age, you just see the same profiles and you're just like, oh, just so unimpressive. And with dating men, their profiles are just so whack on so many levels. There's no personality, or sometimes it's too much personality. But like, ooh. Like, no, let me keep swiping, you know, or like I said, they message you, they don't have nothing to say, or they want to hop on the phone real quick. I'm like, I don't even know you, Jack. Let's message you in the app first. And then if I feel okay, we can switch over to another app, or I can give you my number. It's just like, I just feel like it gets worse and worse with more tools that we have to engage with each other. It's just like the lack of ability to communicate and engage just dwindles. So I'm considering matchmaking because I'm like,
I fuck with
I'm tired of taking breaks. I do want to be partnered, but I'm just like, I don't want to be sifting through the trash.
Sometimes you got to outsource that labor, and dating is labor. So
I'm all about delegation this year. So that would be something I delegate.
We gotta follow up with you about that. I'm very curious to see how that goes. Do you have like a matchmaker in mind, or is this just still the?
I do. Me and someone I'm cool with, we're looking at doing a service. She has already started, and I realize I'm in a good season right now to where I don't want a distraction right now. Even if it's a good distraction, I was talking to somebody. So I may jump on board probably after my birthday in September. So September going to later half of the year, I think I may jump into it. So I may have some stories for you.
All right. So we're going to follow up around November. Okay. Yes, maybe around Christmas time.
Y'all stay
tuned. Taking someone home for the holidays?
That would be nice. That would be nice. Have a post-pandemic day.
Yes. I affirm that for you.
Yes.
Name and claim it.
So here we are talking about the labor it is in dating with a woman with your identity, sifting through the trash that is the dating apps. And kind of going back to what you talked about in wanting this, you know, playful dynamic as a sub and as a little girl, and wanting to be cared for and not to be in a place of dominance in both, occupational and just general life, kind of being able to lay that down and be cared for. What does that look like when you think about being a switch? Because that means there are times where you want to take on that dominance. And let's start first with when and how did you learn that you were a switch?
I think for me, I do want that, you know, sub aspect, but I want to be able to channel that dominance in a different way to where it allows me to, just be dominant over men, you know, and knowing that there are men who are like that, you know, and in having like my own subs, that there would not be people that I would actually date, you know, just to kind of keep that boundary there. But yeah, just to kind of, I guess, as a disabled woman, as somebody who is viewed as weak, to really turn that on its head, you know, because I'm under 4 feet tall, I'm in the chair. People don't really expect me to be, you know, aggressive or to be outspoken or to just be like, you know, wanting to whip you, you know, for a situation or give punishment. And I just really want to tap into that more and just allow myself to be dominant in a different sense, you know, and to kind of go from being dominant in my everyday life, in my work and in my engagements, you know, in the roles that I play for different people, to be a dominant in a sexual sense, you know, and to have a partner who's willing to allow that, who's willing to experience that. So that work really got me thinking about being a switch, you know, in that way of having quote unquote pets, you know, that, you know, I can engage with, you know, in a more aggressive manner. I don't really see myself being, you know, on the extreme side of being a dominant person, you know, like, you know, as being severely punishing or anything like that with whips and things of that nature, but to give some type of punishment. And also flipping it on its head to really doing that to white men. That is the group that I want to do that to. Like, I have no interest in being a switch to men of color, because I feel like men of color get, you know, beaten down literally and figuratively enough. But to punish white men, yes, I want to do that. And have them pay me to do that, yes, I would take their money.
Yes. That's the line. That's the line. That's to punish white men, yes, I would love to do that. Put that on a t-shirt.
Yes.
And for money? Oh, yeah. Count me in.
Yeah. You know.
Is there any overlap in what you're looking for in a dom and how you want and who you are as a dom?
I think the confidence is the main criteria, you know, in having a dom and then being a dom. But for me, I get to be a little bit more aggressive, particularly if I'm, you know, having white men as pets, just to kind of really make them serve me in a more aggressive tone, you know, and that part I'm still learning about. I'm not as familiar with how to do that entirely. I know there are Black women who do, you know, do that professionally and still really learning on that rim. But I just think it would be just really cool for Black women, Black families to just really find a way to be dominant, whether it's to white men or whomever that you want to engage with, in a way to kind of regain some power back. And I think that's what I look at it for me is regaining that power that's been stripped away from me just because I exist. And to really channel that in a way to where, you know, someone gets satisfied, you know, in their own sexual needs. And I get satisfied and be able to provide that.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. I dig it. One of my favorite moments in Black history was shout out to Mistress Unknown and Ebony Femdom, who took a video on Instagram. She Milly rocked and she like bitch slept.
This love, white guy. Always love it.
And I think she fucked him in the ass. Perfect, perfect. All right, we're going to read a quick break before getting into things. But up next, we're going to talk about sex work and sex therapy. So hang on for that. But yeah, let's just talk about general information on therapy for a minute. So therapy is really cool. I dig it. I especially think it's cool when there's something interfering with your happiness or preventing you from achieving your goals. Something like, I don't know, bigotry, sex negativity, ableism, queer phobia in these here United States. I don't know. Things be bad. But for me, a therapy service that really helps me out on the happiness front is my favorite online therapy service, BetterHelp. BetterHelp will assess your needs and match you with your own licensed professional therapist. Plus, you can start communicating in under 48 hours. It's not a crisis line. It's not self-help. It is professional counseling done securely online. There is a broad range of expertise available, which may not be locally available in many areas. The service is available for clients worldwide. You can log into your account anytime and send a message to your counselor. You'll get timely and thoughtful responses. Plus, you can schedule weekly video or phone sessions so you won't ever have to sit in an uncomfortable waiting room as with traditional therapy. BetterHelp is committed to facilitating great therapeutic matches, so they make it easy and free to change counselors if needed. It's more affordable than traditional offline counseling, and financial aid is available. BetterHelp, along with we here at the Inner Hall Uprising, want you to start living a happier life today. You can visit their website and read their testimonials that are posted online daily. Visit betterhelp.com/IHU, that's Better H-E-L-P, and join the over 1 million people who have taken charge of their mental health with the help of an experienced professional. In fact, so many people have been using BetterHelp that they are recruiting additional counselors in all 50 states. This podcast is sponsored by BetterHelp, and Inner Hall Uprising listeners get 10% off their first month by going to betterhelp.com/IHU. That's betterhelp.com/IHU. Okay, should we take it to sex work or sex therapy?
Let's go to sex work. And, okay. You know, we're talking about doming white men for money. So let's get into the work and the payment for that first.
Good natural segue. So yeah, Avilissa, in your pitch email, you mentioned wanting to dip your toes into sex work when you get older. I'm assuming the kind of sex work that you're talking about is doming white men. But did you? Okay.
Yeah, that and maybe doing being a voice actress. Mm. I think that's proper term for it, like doing like phone sex, like and also wanted to like the feet fetish. Ooh. You know, aspects.
A spread of sex work, if you will. Yes, I have offerings. Yes.
Exactly. So I have talked with a Black disabled sex worker that I've got to know over the past year. Her name is Sin and Love, and she's created this collective for BIPOC sex workers during the pandemic. And I interviewed her for an article that came out this year. And she was one of the first ones who I really talked more about, you know, how do you get into this business, particularly on the online aspects of it. And one of the things I talked to her about was the feet fetish and voice acting and, well, phone sex and figuring out, you know, how do you do that in the 21st century, you know, and how these things. So she kind of gave me an understanding of the quote unquote business of sex work, because sex work is work and it is a business, you know, whether you're, you know, dealing with the public physically or you're doing it virtually, you know. So just really having an idea of what the virtual aspect of that looks like. So yeah, it's definitely something that I want to do earlier with phone sex. It really started when we talked about the chat room, which, like, you talk to guys and, you know, do the little nasty stuff on the phone before we even really text messaging really well, you know, back then, you know. So just really realizing that, wow, you know, doing this for free.
I could get a little change.
You know? You know, so I'm like, well, you know, they seem to like it, you know, like it, I love it. So that's great. So, and also people tell me that I have a nice voice. I don't hear it, but
I hear,
you know, if you say I have a nice voice, cool. But just like, don't hear it. Don't even like to hear my voice on anything, but people like it. So I'm like, okay, cool. So might as well use my voice in that way. And that also kind of segues into me wanting to get into voice acting, which is, you know, non-sex work, you know, when it comes to you know, doing different commercials and things of that nature. So having that duality of how I want to use my voice, whether it's for sex work or whether it's for different industry. And also, like, the foot fetish, you know, being, I'm not comfortable with showing off my body in a way. It's not like subconsciousness, but it's just not something that I'm comfortable with. But I show off my feet. You know, like, and no, people love feet.
They do. They do.
And I have small feet. And it's my way of, as I was saying earlier, taking back, you know, the weakness parts that people try to strip from me. And I can, if I want to exploit my body, particularly my, you know, very disabled body, you know, then it's going to be on my terms. And so if I am comfortable with showing off my feet, why not? So that's something that I'm having in the back of my mind to really look into, you know, the next couple of years and try to figure out, okay, how do I, you know, build this part of, in some ways, my work, you know, getting into sex work and, you know, also bringing that advocacy aspect in there too. Because one thing that I talked about with Cinnamon Love is the way that disabled people are treated within the adult femme industry and within sex work in general, and the visibility of that, and just the shifting of the culture within that particular space on how disabled people are treated, you know, the feminization, you know, regaining that power back, reducing the ableism. So really seeing how to bring and be a part of the conversation when it comes to educating and to reducing stigma and harm that has been done to disabled sex workers, no matter what type of sex work they engage in. So really being a part of that conversation too. So still finding some way to be an advocate, even within, you know, my desire to be a phone actress or to get into the fetishizing realm.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. I love it. I love it. We need the matchmaking updates. We need the sex work updates, because...
It's just the part two coming, because yeah, we need to know.
Also, for just to say, because I was on mute, I love your voice. Akua, I love your voice. I could see a duo in the future, a sex work duo, if that's something that y'all want to practice. No. But I'm also always looking for voice actors for another podcast that I produce. So, Vilas, I'm just going to hit you up.
Yeah, please do. Because I don't have a demo reel, but that's something that's, I'm in the work for it. Yeah, like, definitely hit me up. I definitely want to start doing the projects to build up, you know, my repertoire. So yeah, definitely.
Mm-hmm. You know, what's cool, crazy, is that I've been thinking about sex phone operating as another source of income coming up in the very near future, because I'm broke and I need money. I need more money. So to hear you say this, I'm like, we definitely can pair up. I do love your voice, Vilissa. There's this southernness to it that, yes, I feel like some people may be fetishizing it, like, as like a southern mammy, but I love your voice nonetheless. So yes, I'm going to pencil that into my goal book, and we're going to see what we can do, if we can make a couple things shake. But my question to you, because my idea is to be doing both concurrently, still being a therapist and a sex worker. Do you see that for yourself in doing sex work concurrently with the work that you're doing now? Or is this like a complete shift to a different source of primary income for you?
I think that right now I have a very strong interest in sex work, but I probably would have to keep it, for the time being, separate, only because I have a children's book that I want to have out at one point. And I know that those worlds cannot mesh, you know, like, it's going to have to be a separate identity, mm-hmm, until I get this book off the ground. And that's due to, you know, how children's books, you know, children, kid lit, you know, that whole thing and that whole energy and that genre. So that's the only reason why it would be separate at this time. You know, whenever I do get into sex work. But you know, the sex therapist stuff. I can do that now, but that can be a part of my work. So there won't be such a taboo, you know, or in some ways, quote unquote, harm my chances as a, you know, aspiring children's author. But the sex work part, I have to be kind of on the low until, you know, I get these books out the way.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
You know, and that's the realities of just understanding the taboo-ness of sex, you know, and especially sex work, you know, just understanding that there's certain things that you're going to have to, you're going to know that's going to quote unquote disadvantage you in some ways that it shouldn't have to be at all. Because I'm like, I'm doing this for kids. like the kids are not my audience here, but uptight adults, you know, who may also in some ways be sexually oppressed or not able to really force their own sexual needs, they're going to look at that a certain way. And I want to have a prosperous career, you know, as a children's book author. And I know that's important to me. So just understanding those dynamics as well.
Aku was about to ask a question, but I just want to like take a moment to like, you're already the most Googleable everything on your goddamn resume. Like,
and
the
she list just goes on. Adding.
Yeah, and you're just like, yeah, I wanted to be a children's book author. I want to be a sex worker. I love it.
I gotta channel my inner
Violet. I gotta check
Violet.
My ambitions real quick. Like, I thought I did really, it all.
Violet's putting me to shame. Violet said, no, not enough, boo. Yeah.
Like,
I think I blame my grandmother in a good way because, you know, she never told me what I couldn't do because I was disabled. And that's not the experience of a lot of disabled people. You know, like they're, you know, even in quote unquote well-meaning senses, you know, they're told like, you know, you can't do something because you're disabled. My grandmother's like, you want to do it, fine. Just know your physical limitations so you don't hurt yourself.
Mm.
You know, particularly as a little kid, if you're clumsy, you don't pay attention. But, you know, she's just like, okay. You're like, nothing that I wanted to do, I was told no. You know, and I know that she had her own concerns about what I could do based on, you know, diagnosis. Because for those who may not know, I have a layman's term would be brittle bone disease. So, you know, just born with brittle bones condition, you know, and given the life expectancy of 4 to 8 years, you know, so they really kind of, in some ways, shaped her understanding of what my life could be like, but also allowed her to really allow me to be free for however long that, you know, I would be alive. So, yeah, so really my grandmother's to blame for me to be so ambitious and to have, you know, just list of things that I want to do. And, you know, I just know that my only setback is me, you know, if I don't get something accomplished. So just really knowing that I can achieve whatever I want to. And I just really, as a Black disabled person, I know how blessed I am to have that type of scope and have that nurture from a very young age. Cause I know that a lot of us don't in this community. And so, yeah. So my grandmother's too rightfully and lovingly to blame for that.
Shout out to your Mima. Yeah. Thank you. Cause you have, she has nurtured a bad bitch into this world.
Yeah, we love to see it.
We
simply love to see
appreciate.
It.
Yeah. Yes. So I want to jump into, you know, your ambitions to be a sex therapist, because same, it's kind of what I've always wanted to merge my interest in therapy with the sexual world and the work that I do here. What started that? What ignited the fire for that? What does that journey look like for you at the moment?
Yes. So for me, in my professional hat, I'm a macro social worker. So that is, well, some people don't know this. There's two types of social workers. The micro, what you think of, the stereotypical social worker, like case management therapist, someone who works with groups, child services, the things that nature. Macro deals with like the bigger picture, the systems, the advocacy, the political, engaging with the community, some of them work in higher ed and so forth. So I started off, particularly in grad school, doing micro work, interning at the organization that served those with HIV/AIDS and then at a dialysis center. So I understood the system, you know, how the system oppresses clients and, you know, workers, you know, within them. And also shifted to macro, understanding the dysfunction of the systems and how it trickles down to really impacting communities, groups, individuals, and those who work with those communities, groups, and individuals. So having that, you know, dual understanding really helped me see things from the bottom top and the top bottom, and to really see where the dysfunction lies on both levels. And, you know, I went to grad school wanting to be a therapist. That was my whole thing. And when I learned about macro, that just really flipped everything on its head. I'm like, wow, you know, I can really do this stuff. So I have no desire necessarily to be a clinical social worker, you know, just centering mental health necessarily, but I do want to do some therapeutic things. So at this time, I kind of put the little, I've kind of put that journey slightly on hold because I know I want to build up to being a sick educator and then hopefully one day be a sex therapist to where I really center the experiences of Black women, especially Black single women, because I feel like there's not enough representation within that particular realm of us in general, and especially us talking about disability and sexuality. But even as a social worker now, and I've done talk, I'm talking with you all about sex stuff, so I'm digging a little bit into that work, you know, without the clinical certification of a sex educator, but can still do that work as I'm trying to figure out, you know, the journey that I want to do that particular aspect. But this is my whole thing of talking to sex worker, excuse me, sex therapists, you know, who do this work. They're like, yeah, we need, you know, more Black women. We especially need more Black disabled women in this space because the disabled people that are in this space are white, you know. And again, you know, my whole career has been about filling the gaps, and that would just be doing that again in this sense of filling the gap that is mostly needed.
And speaking of filling in the gaps, what do you see in the space of sex education and sex therapy that's not currently being addressed or is under addressed or that you like ultimately want to target?
I see the same thing as I see in the reproductive justice space of just the absence of talking about disability. Mm-hmm. You know, the absence of us being there physically in this space, you know, really talk about it openly, but just the, you know, reluctance to really dig deeper that goes outside of the textbook understanding of disability and sex. Having a more intersectional understanding, having that more diversity that I say that's missing. Just really getting to the nitty gritty of stuff, you know, and engaging with some of the Black women who are sex therapists, you know, just really hearing some of their accounts of that particular world and like what they're bringing into it. Just really seeing that space has a lot to learn about Black women and sexuality in general, and especially when you break it down by certain identities. So just really coming into a space to where the work is starting to be done, but just understanding that it still has a long way to go, you know, when it comes to really hitting sex and sexuality, sexual expression in a very clear way. And also us not being real about the sexual violence that disabled people endure. That doesn't get talked about enough, particularly for disabled women and especially disabled women who have intellectual developmental disabilities, the disparities there. So just really, when we talk about sexual violence, you know, the erasure of disability is so profound that it does the work being done a grave disservice. Because if you're leaving disabled people and particularly disabled women and families out of the conversation, then how can you really empower people when people's power are being taken away and people are being violated? It's such harmful ways. Understanding that violence against disabled people is always just sexual. You know, even though I'm talking about sexual violence here, but it can be financial. It could be our parents, it could be our caregivers, you know, violating us as well. Like we talk about intimate violence, you know, it's not just, you know, just our intimate partners, but it, those who are, you know, assisting us in our care, you know, those who are ensuring that, so are supposed to ensure that we are taken care of financially, the financial abuse that goes with that. So really getting people to understand the disability specific issues within intimate partner violence, or just intimate violence, sexual violence, or any type of violence against disabled people is key. Because honestly, we don't even get into the rate of disability within police violence as a lot of Black folks who experience it. So we're really missing this huge gap of connecting disability and violence in pretty much all the scopes of violence that can occur amongst people. So I think that's something that I'm really passionate about and really bring it to that space. And also just being real about having these honest conversations about what it means to engage in sex and to date and to partner and to parent as disabled people. For Mother's Day this year, I did an article on Black disabled moms, and that's not a group that when we talk about parenting, get a lot of visibility within the disabled community, the Black community, and in general. So just really finding ways to really have these conversations that we're having amongst ourselves in these subgroups and bringing it broader so that everybody can understand things better.
You are changing and are going to change the world in so many beautiful ways. And I'm just very excited to see.
I am just, my mind cannot even fathom or hold the, I don't even got the words, Vylissa, my Lord. I just.
You silenced the Kua.
And that's hard to do.
I just only been doing this work for 8 years. So it's like, I'm just like scratching the surface. Yeah. You know, and in many ways, in having these conversations, because, you know, what I love about being doing this work at this time is that there are, especially with the internet and social media, it allows us to have these more robust conversations that we were not having 20 years ago, 30 years ago, 40 years ago, and especially with them being intersectional at that, you know, because this disability history is very white dominated. So, you know, being a Black disabled person, we've always been, you know, doing this, we've always been in these spaces, but to have that visibility, you know, is shifting.
With all of that, is there anything else you want to share with our listeners that we have not even touched?
Because we could
yet.
Have this conversation for 5 hours.
We literally could.
Melissa, Melissa got to go take a nap as we discussed before exactly. we started.
Look, I'm a little awake now. I have to wait.
It's Sunday, y'all.
Yeah. But yeah, any last words you'd like to share with the listeners? Anything upcoming that you want them to be tuned in and ready for?
The one thing I always like to say is that if your work does not include disability, and especially if it does not include Black disabled people, it will be incomplete. So just understand that disability is a part of pretty much every social issue that you care about. And it's up to you to really find that angle and to really see the gap within your work, the gap that exists when it comes to disability, and how to be a better accomplice or co-conspirator in the work for and the fight for freedom and liberation. So yeah, that's something I always like to say, because people see this, if they see disability at all, they kind of have it as this far off thing, which is very integrated. Like, we're the largest minority group in this country and world, the largest. And especially if you are a Black disabled person, you know, we have a high prevalence rate of disability. So as a Black person, you know, either you yourself have a disability, somebody you know and love has a disability, and it's something that needs to be on our radar as a community. Those are the last words I would give, is to really look at any issue you care about with education, healthcare, state violence, you know, whatever it is.
Access to
there's
food.
A disability angle. Yeah. Yeah. You know, even sex, you know, sex work, there's a disability angle there. You know, so just really look into that and to really educate yourself. And especially now that we have the internet, there's no reason for you not to do so. You know, if you listen to this podcast, you have an internet connected somewhere where you can Google and look things up. And I think that is the beauty of this time that we're living in, is that information is literally, you know, in our faces. And it's up to us to really find it and nurture our understanding and push that forward into the world. But for me and the work that I'm doing right now, due to the pandemic, it has been a amazing season of doing trainings and workshops and panels and events. So I am available as a speaker, consultant, writer, trainer for your organizations, no matter the size. You know, I do charge, so I'm not doing any type of free labor. So that is not my ministry at this point. You know, but we are pay Black women around here, you know, pay Black femmes around here. So if you want to hire me for my services, I am all online for that. You want to bring me in to your university, to your school, you know, to speak on things, I'm available for that, because I know, you know, the fall's coming up. I know everybody's looking for things to happen. So, because this is the work that I'm doing full time. I went on a roll of faith early last year and being on my own. And it's been a wonderful journey, particularly during the pandemic, to have my own business and not be working for somebody else. So this is the work that I've been doing. I've been loving pretty much every project that I've been a part of, from just coming in to talk about speakers, to even talk about accessibility in this virtual space and assistant organizations in that way. Basically, I am a Jill of many things, you know, so definitely reach out to me. I also have a Patreon that you can support for less than $2 a month at patreon.com/wrapyourvoice. And, you know, yeah, I'm doing all the things right now.
Vilissa said, I will do it all for a check.
For a yes. fee. Yes. Okay. Yes.
Look, you have to make that well known for people to come to you.
No, they will. They will. People be on some flex shit. People definitely be on some flex shit.
Where can the folks find you, Vilissa? I already said Google her, but help us out.
And we'll
out
put the Patreon
bit.
In the show notes.
Yes. You can find me on Twitter. That's where I'm mostly at, even though I have a strange relationship with Twitter because it's Twitter, but that's my main platform engagement at Vilissa Thompson, but also at Ramp Your Voice, since the business has its own page. You'll also find me at rampyourvoice.com, of course, the Patreon. Yeah, just hit me up, you know, if you have any questions, you want to know more about my services and what I do, or if you just want to say hello. I love meeting new people.
Oh, this has been such a great episode. Thank you for joining us.
Vilissa, the fact that we were even on your radar in the bad bitchery that you
I do,
are.
I feel honored.
I feel so honored. Like, I'm sitting here like, she know me.
Like, this whole little podcast.
I love y'all podcast. Oh, I love
you. This little podcast. Oh my goodness. Thank you so much for reaching out to
thank
us. This was an
me.
Amazing conversation. I am definitely looking forward to, you know, hitting you back up in the falls and seeing where some of these things
just
is.
To check in. Just to check
yes.
in.
Yes. Love to come back.
Cool. All right. Dope. If this episode has made you laugh, helped you learn something, made you feel good, made you question yourself in a good way, or positively moved you in any sense, please leave us a rating and review on Apple Podcasts or Stitcher and let everyone you know that you love these hoes. We appreciate you all. If you particularly enjoyed this episode, you could just be on Apple Podcasts, write your review like, yo, I really love that episode with Vilissa. I learned a lot. That's it. It takes That's 2 seconds to help a hoe out. Where can they follow us, Cool?
If you'd like to follow us on social media, again, you can do so at Inaho Uprising without the G on these Twitter streets, at Inaho Uprising with the G on Instagram and Facebook. You can and should join our Facebook community group by searching Inaho Uprising Community, that is C-U-M-M-U-N-I-T-Y. And definitely head over to InahoUprising.com to pay a hoe and check out some upcoming merch. You guys can follow me, Akua, at Hey Akua Girl on Instagram, Twitter, Clubhouse, TikTok, all places.
All the tings. You can follow me at Slam Red on Instagram and Twitter. And a reminder that this podcast is sponsored by BetterHelp. And you guys, you folks, the listeners, get 10% off your first month by going to betterhelp.com/IHU. Have a lovely motherfucking week because you deserve to. Oh, look how bars.
Bye.
Bye.